I'm Lynn Cherry. I'm the children's book author and illustrator and the producer, director of these films, Young Voices for the Planet. And three of our panelists they star in these films. And so I'm going to introduce our panelists, and then each panelist will have 10 minutes to talk to you about their projects, and then the rest will be open to questions from you. So just as an introduction, there's a lot of environmental problems in the world today, and some young people feel kind of overwhelmed by them, but others realize that they have power to make change. And our panelists today are the second. They realize that they have great power to make a difference in the world, and their examples are showing other young people what they can do. So it's very empowering and inspiring. So Larissa Weinstein and Maddie Callan they star in this movie here, Dreaming in Green. They're now students at Coral Gables High School in Florida. And I met them when I heard about their project at their middle school, which was Carver Middle School. And they had done an energy audit and saved their school $53,000. So you'll see a little bit of Dreaming in Green. We'll play that. Sean Russell has a project called Stow It, Don't Throw It. He was at the Marine Laboratory as an intern when he saw a lot of dolphin entanglements and was really concerned, wanted to do something, and he'll tell you about what he did with his project. Jordan Howard is now a student at Santa Monica College, but she is one of the stars in Green Ambassadors, the charter school where they greened up the school in many ways. And Jordan, I think, will talk a little bit about that. I'll show you some of that footage, and then she'll talk about what she's doing today with her book, Green My Parents, and other projects. And Eric Christian will talk about how he created biodiesel in his school. And then when he was told how it was illegal to be doing this, he went and got the laws changed through the state legislature. So pretty remarkable young people. So I'm just going to show you, preview these films for about a minute, and then we'll get on with the panelists. This is...
started, we were in sixth grade.
We were concerned about climate change.
Because of sea level change, Miami, out of all the coastal cities in the world, will have the greatest economic loss.
At a certain point, we couldn't stop thinking, is there anything that we can do?
I'm Nicole Martinez.
I'm Melissa Quintana.
I'm Madeline Cowan.
I'm Larissa Weinstein.
And we're the Green Team!
The Green Team would go around from homeroom to homeroom telling students about one thing that they could do to reduce their carbon footprint.
We started by turning off computers.
We began to recycle. We turned off lights. We actually weather stripped the doors and windows so that the air can't escape to conserve air conditioning.
We turned off the AC units. Instead, we opened the windows and the doors. We could hear birds singing outside.
There are so many little things that you can do that will save energy and money.
Throughout the school year, we had this thing called the greenometer. It was a thermometer app that we would save energy that we were saving.
We became a Dreaming Green School, which is a nonprofit that helps us to save energy, reduce our carbon footprint. We save tens of thousands of dollars.
We learn how our actions affect the environment and affect something greater than ourselves.
My friends and I called in somebody to give us an estimate on putting in solar panels. The man who came in emphasized that before we need to do this, we can try to reduce our energy consumption. And one of the great ideas that he gave us was to paint the roof of our school white. We convinced them to actually donate all the materials, the time, and the manpower to paint the roof of our school white.
Painting the roof white saved us thousands of dollars. It didn't require as much air conditioning. That translated directly to money savings.
We didn't just do this ourselves. We built an entire network with faculty, administration, students, and other members of the community.
Our principal allowed us to look at energy bills, so we were able to do an energy audit on the entire school.
And you can go online to put in your address, and it does energy audits. It gives you graphs on how much you're saving or what you can do. It gives you tips.
Yeah.
And I think
it compares it to the same month of the previous year.
Just became an incredible project. It became something beyond my wildest dream.
And all of our teachers were very helpful.
We spoke with the custodians and convinced them to play a part in going green.
Sure, a little bit.
Thank you.
If we custodians should see an air conditioner on, we turn it off. So we are going greener, and I'm proud to say that.
We were able to vastly decrease the amount of energy our school used.
Going green is a win-win situation for everybody.
My eighth grade year, we saved $39,000. And then the year after that, we saved another $14,000.
If each school in the district were to implement these, we would have saved $33 million.
That's awesome.
Larissa, Maddie, Melissa, and Nicole wanted to go beyond the classroom with what they had learned about energy and environmental science and make a difference in their school and community.
We made a presentation for school board members about how the entire district could be more environmentally friendly.
They were extremely inspired, and they also saw the financial benefits of going green.
The savings were astronomical. It was exciting to go to these school board members. You could show them the data. You could say, look, you have no idea how much money you could be saving.
Our students went and spoke to the authorities at the Miami International Airport.
Throughout our presentations with the school board chairman, with Miami International Airport, we emphasized that it doesn't take that much to reduce your energy consumption.
We were taken seriously because we had real statistics and information. We could show the people at the airport, this is how much you will save.
It was something that we were really very proud of. Not only are we making a change at the school level, but we're trying to make a change citywide, nationwide, worldwide.
Maddie and I graduated from here at Carver, and we then moved on to Coral Gables High School. Coming off this sort of high of change and excitement and everything we were doing here at Carver, we had a list. We wanted everything we had done at Carver to happen at Gables. Almost the entire school at this point is recycling paper and plastic and cans. Going green really helps save money everywhere. 75% of the money that we save at our school gets returned to us. We've saved $4,000 or $5,000 this year at Gables High alone. Small changes that add up to big savings.
You can save millions of dollars, and this is just one small county in Florida. Can you imagine if every other county did this? Can you imagine if every other state did this?
It's right on so many levels, you know, a moral level and a financial level.
And despite all these obstacles, just if you keep trying, you can't lose. You're saving money, and more importantly, you're saving the planet.
Kids do have power. Kids have a say in what happens.
I felt like I could change things. I could just strap on my cape and go.
Thank you. So these films are being distributed by, we're doing a curriculum with National Geographic. Earth Echo will be sharing them, and a lot of other groups. So I want to now turn this over to Larissa and Maddie. And I would like the panelists to address these few questions, how it was that they took it upon themselves to make change, whether they believe that other young people feel hopeful about the future or not, and what it is within themselves that has made them feel that they want to take that, become civically engaged and take that personal responsibility. Larissa and Maddie.
Where should we start? I guess we can start with at Carver, how we were able to do what we did.
A big part of that was a very supportive administration, a principal who was completely pro-green, supportive of our efforts, teachers, custodians, everyone wanted to help us succeed with our efforts.
Yeah, and you can definitely see a difference at Gables because although we do still have a very supportive administration, it's a school of 3,300 kids and going green is not a priority. So I think we've sort of changed from having to take like certain actions with our school to now focusing on awareness. So in terms of like, do our kids these days hopeful? I think once people find out about it, I think young people can be really hopeful because we're very creative. We have a lot of ideas. But the biggest obstacle is, of course, not knowing anything about the problem or that there are any solutions.
Yeah, I mean, at Carver, it was a smaller community, and everyone who was there really wanted to be there. So we would have, like, a field day event, and everyone would help us clean up the recycling at the end of the day. But Gables is a bigger school. Not all of it is the Magnet IB program. It's harder to get people involved.
What was the role of the administration in your school? Did you have to have buy-in from the school principals? Was it a teacher who helped you, or was it mostly coming from the student body?
At Carver at least, and actually at both Carver and Gables, any of the ideas that we have, any of these energy audits have to be accepted by the principal. He or she is the only one able to let us take any of these actions with the school and the only one able to communicate with the district because some of the energy management programs that we implement have to be approved by the district. So in terms of their support, it's them saying yes or no to any of our ideas. And then at Carver, we had Ms. Vasquez, who was an amazing teacher, very supportive, very engaging and passionate, which was definitely a big help. But all of the presentations that we put together to give to the Miami International Airport or to the school board, that was all student done. We spent hours and hours researching after school. We had meetings to practice them, and it was completely us.
Yeah. Did your project require separate funding, or was it all just sweat equity?
It was probably mostly sweat equity. At Gables, actually, was where we've needed more funds, per se, to do things like we have a reusable water bottle fundraiser going on. But high school clubs, it's easier to fundraise. That wasn't really an option in middle school, so we've had the opportunity to fundraise, so we've been able to do things that required funds.
One of the things that I think is really important is to see that even if some action that you're doing to try to save energy has an initial cost, eventually it pays off. And so everything that we do for fundraisers at Gables, we try to be some environmental fundraiser that not only helps give us money so we can expand a recycling program or start a new project, but it also, at the same time, contributes to the community somehow. And it's completely possible to do that.
Has your project spread any? Do you know whether there have been other schools that have seen what you've done and then replicated what you've done anywhere in the country or the world?
Dream in Green is in lots of different schools. I mean, we didn't start that. We're just a part of it. So I know there are lots of other schools that are doing similar things with that program. It's a nonprofit organization that was created to help schools in the area be more environmentally friendly.
They run the Dream in Green Green Schools Challenge. And part of this challenge, once your school is part of it, you have mid-year, beginning of the year, and end-of-the-year workshops. And we've spoken at a couple of those and shown our ideas, how we have, like, monthly themes to focus on. And so we do talk to a lot of other teachers. And I have had a couple of discussions about people who want to use the same ideas. And I know Dream in Green actually took our monthly theme idea and is suggesting that people do that this year.
And they actually even showed this video at a Dream in Green event in Indonesia.
Oh, right, yeah. And this the film, I mean, through the film I know that you're getting a lot of exposure. Audubon is using this film in all of their energy audit workshops all around the country. They're now going to be doing an article in Audubon magazine, and so that will feature not just what you've done, but all the other people in the other young people in the films. National Geographic will be getting that out through their nonprofit Explorer project. So I think you'll be getting a lot of exposure through the movies, and that's actually the movies are really to help get these stories more widely seen and to inspire other young people. So, Sean, tell us about what your project did, and if you could talk to us a little bit about how, when you first saw those dolphins entangled in the nets, what kind of your emotional state of mind,
how
that affected you, and how it was that turned into action.
Definitely. Well, to give you a little bit more background about myself, growing up in Florida, I've always been around the ocean, enjoyed going to the beach, and I guess the first inspiration for environmental work really came from my family. Going out, camping, biking, hiking in state parks with my family really gave me that first love for the natural world, and which led to an ultimate desire to help protect it and get involved in conservation work. And going back to always being around the ocean, being around the beach in Florida, and growing up on the Gulf Coast, I had the opportunity to participate in summer camps at Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium when I was starting in fourth grade, and that really opened my eyes to some of the research work going on with conservation, some of the ways that, our planet's oceans were in trouble. And I actually came back to Moat Marine Laboratory when I was in ninth grade as a high school intern, and participated in their program there, learning about their research work and some of their conservation efforts as well. And I also had the opportunity to volunteer for their education programs. So that allowed me to share my love of, marine science and conservation with other students, as well as learn more about how I could get involved and help. And during my second year of that program, we started a partnership with Moat Marine Laboratory's Dolphin Research Project. And one of the things they had seen was an increase in negative human-dolphin interactions in the area around Sarasota County and Sarasota Bay. And they saw an unsustainable death rate, actually, in the world's longest studied wild dolphin population due to human interactions and negative human impacts. And so they partnered with us to carry out a two-year study with the high school students to see if we could come up with some data on some of these problems and community outreach work related to that issue. But one of the first things that I saw during my time working on that project was a generalized presentation by the research program staff about the threats and the impacts that humans were having on the dolphin population around Sarasota. And one of the things that really stood out to me was the impact that fishing line and fishing gear was having on dolphins. It seemed like something that shouldn't be a hard problem to solve, or shouldn't be something that should be such a big issue, but it was really causing a big threat to this dolphin population and other marine wildlife as well. And to give you guys a little bit of an idea, I have a short video I can pull up for you as well.
This one that you made?
Yeah.
So this is a video that Sean made.
So as you can see, those are kind of the images that Lynn was talking about that I first saw that kind of blew me away. I knew about fishing line recycling and being important, but I guess when I saw it firsthand like that, it really hit me hard. Like I said, growing up around Florida, always being connected to the ocean and marine wildlife, and it's kind of the same way with other people too, is they see these animals that we all love, like sea turtles and dolphins and manatees, and when they see carelessly discarded or lost fishing line in the environment entangling these animals, it really hits home for them. And it's really kind of discouraging. And that's how it was for me, too, when I learned that, these dolphins that we see all around, my community are being so negatively impacted by fishing line and by this issue. And the state of Florida actually has a really cool program, and other states are developing similar programs. And it's from Fish and Wildlife in Florida. It's called the Monofilament Recovery and Recycling Program. And you guys, I don't know if some of you have seen these before, but these are big PVC pipe fishing line recycling bins. And they're up on fishing piers, boat ramps, and state parks all across our state and in many coastal counties. Basically, what happens is people can dispose of all their used line properly in these containers, and it stays out of the environment, and it's actually melted down and recycled and turned into artificial reef habitats. So it's a really cool program and a great way to keep fishing line out of the environment. But one of the problems, and as you can see, it's still an issue with entanglement, is the fact that these recycling bins aren't always where people can access them. And if you're out on a boat or out in the field, you might not be able to get to one of these recycling bins and properly dispose of your line. And so that goes back to, you know, this issue that really discouraged me a little bit when I first heard about it and saw these images. And I really wanted to do something to help and help come up with maybe a solution to that problem. And so at the same time, I learned about an idea from one of the scientists that was working with our program at Moat Marine Laboratory to take recycled tennis ball containers and turn them into a personal-sized fishing line recycling bin. Basically something that people could take out on boats with them, always have on their person, and properly store all their line until they could later dispose of it. And I brought one of the bins for you guys to see today, and we can pass that around as well. But basically, to me, this seemed immediately something that was easy for students to do and easy for young people to do, especially those who see this and get discouraged and want to take action and want to help. And also, I was really involved in the Florida 4-H program. I was in a local environmental science 4-H club in Sarasota County, and so that youth network and that youth base kind of seemed like a perfect fit for me to start a project like this. So back in 2008, I started what was called the Stow It, Don't Throw It project. And it was a partnership between my local 4-H club, the Green Team in Sarasota, and Moat Marine Laboratory. And we had a goal of making and distributing these fishing line recycling bins. And they were excited about the idea and the concept of getting involved in this project and how they could have an impact on this serious issue that's affecting wildlife in our state. And I also presented the program to other 4-H clubs around the state to help spread the message and spread the issue to other counties. And at a Marine Ecology 4-H event, I actually presented the project and recruited other clubs and other individuals from around the state of Florida to get engaged and get on board with this project as well. And since that presentation and that time with partnering with 4-H for some of our initial funding and some of our work, we've been able to spread the project to 17 counties around the state of Florida and have passed out about 3,700 fishing line recycling bins to anglers and boaters at state parks and fishing tournaments and things like that. And we've been able to partner young people in each of those counties with partnering environmental organizations, school groups like the Clearwater Aquarium, the Florida Aquarium, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and groups to have that mentoring role of, you know, adults helping out these students to really make sure those projects are very successful in spreading the word and spreading the message about this issue.
Thank you, Sean. That's incredibly inspiring.
And can I share one more thing about it? Can I share one more thing about this as well?
Yeah, we have one more minute.
Okay, perfect. One of the things I would just like to say is we're working on spreading the word to other students as well. And so to the students in the room, there are great organizations out there with resources and action guides and toolkits for you to use to launch your own ocean conservation projects. And one of those, I brought in a book today from Earth Echo International, which was founded by Philippe Cousteau. And for me, involved in ocean conservation work, things like this are great resources for students to go out and use and take the action steps to launch their own ocean conservation projects. So if you guys check out, I'm actually working with them on a program now through my project, and if you check out earthecho.org, you can see their action guides and toolkits and resources that really take you step by step through the process of planning out your own ocean conservation work. So they have a program called the Water Planet Challenge with extra toolkits and resources for students, and they also have this book, which you guys can definitely check out after the program. And they just launched, very relevant to this media conference, journalism conference, a student reporting through environmental action through media program. It's all through their website, and you guys can actually share the work that students do with others. And also, students can use videos to share the environmental issues that are really important and that they're passionate about in their areas. So you guys can check that out. Some great resources at Earth Echo as well.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Thank you.
It's earthecho.org.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd like to thank Earth Echo for helping to bring Absolutely. Sean down here. So, Sean, can you get the other movie back on here, because I just wanted to show the movie that Jordan is the documentary where of Green Ambassadors, where Jordan and some of her fellow students. And they give, I think, a very cogent description of what global climate change is as well. Yeah. Okay. And if we could have the lights down. Can this be made louder?
We declare you graduated as Green Ambassadors.
The thing about the Green Ambassadors, which is so powerful to me and I love it, is because we get to do the solutions. It's not the teacher doing it. It's actually youth empowering youth because we're in charge of it.
In our Green Ambassadors class, we work on projects that can help our school first, and then we can go out in the community to teach others about it. And, of course, that all goes back to our ecological footprint and with climate change.
Here in the United States, we're trying to change it, and many countries don't see that. They just think that we're bad, we're the big monster that wants to destroy the planet. Most of our energy comes from fossil fuels, like oil, natural gas, and coal. Once you burn them, they emit CO2, and the greenhouse gases are like laying a blanket on our planet, and it's heating it up.
And our school is going through a green transformation.
Our school, we had a lunch system that would create so much waste. So last semester, we worked on a project called Clean Plate Club.
These are our waste stations. We have compost, fruits, vegetables, eggshells. We have recycled, so plastic bottles only, numbers 1 and 2. And we have landfill. And we want to raise awareness, and we also want people to see what can go in the landfill. Right here is our method of compost. We're using an old bathtub to put our organic matter from the waste bins. Worms are breaking it down to compost. We're going to get good, healthy soil for our plants, our fruit trees. We planted 60 different fruit trees with over 30 varieties. Trees get the carbon dioxide out of the air, so planting more trees can reduce your carbon footprint. The coolest thing for me was that we actually got to plant the trees, so we can go back 20 years later and say, hey, I planted that avocado tree, I planted that kiwi tree. And we also went into the community door to door asking people, do you want a kiwi tree? Do you want an avocado tree? We planted 40 different trees in the community. To me, that's the most important thing, to educate people, because they don't know. I don't like when we judge other people instead of teaching them.
One way that our school has taken our learnings and teachings out to the rest of the community, to the rest of the city. We teach little kids about what they can do and take back to their homes, to their schools, to make their school environmentally friendly. They're trying to reduce plastic, getting canteens, and so that they don't have to be buying plastic bottles.
We're at the Environmental Youth Conference, and I'm dressed as a plastic bag monster. Everyone is walking up to me, taking pictures and laughing. But this is a serious problem. Climate change is hitting us. I mean, we need solar panels. We need wind energy. We don't need to be going offshore drilling for oil. There are the solutions, but we need to use them. You'd really be surprised what one Earth Positive solution can do to a community. We're doing all of this for the seventh generation, for my sister's kids and her kids, kids, kids.
We can do the simplest things to make this world a better place.
I can learn how to care about the Earth. You can too.
You can make a difference.
So Jordan,
thank you, yeah. Thank you. That was like 4 years ago, so I've grown up since then a lot. I'm now a sophomore in college. That was when I was a sophomore in high school. So it's different to see how I talk and what I was talking about. That was actually my first interview too. And since then, so I went to a green high school. I went to a green high school because it was the best high school in my neighborhood. It was a charter school, so it was a college prep school. And that was I wanted to go to college. My mom wanted me to go to college, so we thought that that was the best school. It was a small school, about 420 kids. And so I went to, I say that because I didn't go to the environmental charter high school because I was an environmentalist and I wanted to grow up and save the planet. I was very resistant to the green movement, to climate change, to anything green before I went to that school. Actually, before I took that
Green Ambassador class my 10th grade year. My 9th grade year, I used to always get in trouble. I mean, we went to the Bayona wetlands. We had field trips to the landfill, to the wetlands, and I was always the only person that was bold enough. I mean, my other classmates, they didn't care either, but I was the only one that used to say, hey, Ms. Katz, why are you teaching us this? Why are we learning about global warming? Why are you trying to force us to be environmentalists? And I just always ask crazy questions because I was a rebel. But I learned my 10th grade year that I was resistant to the green movement, that I was resistant to the environmental world because I didn't know. I wasn't educated. I didn't know. I thought that global warming was fake. I thought it was a hoax because I didn't know about global warming. I used to hear in the media and in TV and reading about global warming, but it was never about solutions. It was never solution-based. It was never what I could do in my lifestyle to actually make a difference. It was always, you're bad because you drive. You're bad because you shower. You're bad because you eat this. But it was never, you know what? You can have meatless Mondays. You don't have to eat meat every meal. It was never, you know, you can drive less. You can use transportation. And it was never an education. Like, I knew what solar panels were. I knew solar panels were, you know, energy from the sun. But I didn't know you could get energy when there was no sun. I didn't know. And that's what I found out, that was one of the things that the green movement lacked, at least for me, my community, where I come from. There was no environmental education. It was just an environment, and I saw that. So after that, I made sure that everything that I did from that day on, when I had that whole epiphany inside class, everything that I did, I'm always educating. So to make sure that my main focus would. So I've done projects from plastics to, I'm also a public speaker, so from plastics to environmental films, but it's always about educating people. The main focus is to make sure that we're teaching people to change their lifestyles and making it solution-based. So since then, I created a Rise Above Plastics program. Since we were just talking about the ocean, I created a Rise Above Plastics program with the Surfrider Foundation, which is a global nonprofit. Anybody ever heard of the Surfrider Foundation? So with Rise Above Plastics, Surfrider has a Rise Above Plastics program, and Rise Above Plastics is basically adults that go around to colleges teaching college students how to rise above plastics, teaching them how the plastics are harmful for their human body and for the environment. Youth program.
Is it Rise Above?
Rise Above. Rise Above. Rise Above Plastics. But there was no youth program. So what I created was the Youth Rise Above Plastics Student Speaker Series, where we changed the presentation. We made it relevant to youth, and we went into schools. I trained high schoolers, so there were 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grader students, and we went into high schools, middle schools, elementary schools, and businesses taught them how to rise above plastics, but it was from a kid's perspective. And this presentation was never given to kids, and I think that youth are the most powerful. Every generation, the most powerful will be the youth. So I wanted to teach youth, and I wanted youth to teach youth. And that was one program that we did. We actually took that Rise Above Plastics, and a year later, we ended up going to about 50 presentations. So the first year, we reached about 1,200 students in Los Angeles. And then we partnered with the Algolita Marine Research Foundation. Anybody heard about that gyre that's in the middle of the ocean? And it's like a plastic island. So we partnered with the Algolita Marine Research Foundation and created Plastics Are Forever, which is an international youth summit where youth can sign up. I think that it's international youth summit where we actually, so our goal last year, it was to bring in at least two international, when we say international, we wanted at least two international countries, maybe Canada, maybe somebody from Mexico, Colombia. It ended up being 14 different countries represented in the room. So out of 120 youth, there were 14 different countries from Kenya, Zambia, Colombia, Chile, Canada, everywhere. I can't even, it was everywhere. It was amazing to see how many. So there were and youth from all over the country, and we got together 3 days in Long Beach. We were right on the beach in Los Angeles, and we talked plastics. We taught them how to present. We taught them public speaking skills. We had keynote speakers like Ed Begley Jr., Philippe Cousteau. It was amazing. And next year, March, look out for that. Plastics Are Forever Youth Summit. So the summit, we were able to get a grant from Disney Friends for Change, where the only thing that the youth had to do was get there, and everything else was taken care of. So as long as you handle your transportation, whether you want to fly, drive, we can, after you go, we'll put you up for 3 days. I also edited a book called Green My Parents, and which Sean is a part of as well. So Green My Parents is a, I forgot, I'm so sorry that I don't have the book. I left it on my bed. I had a 4 a.m. flight. So Green My Parents is a book geared to kids 9 to 16 years old. And the book is, it's how to green your parents, but teach them how to live sustainably, but it's all about money, saving money. So how to live sustainably, but also save money. So you say, hey, mom and dad, I can shave 10% off of your electricity bill. Let me show you how. And after I shave 10% off, I want that money to go towards my allowance. Or I want that money to go towards family vacation. I want that money to go towards my new car that I'm going to have. So it's teaching kids how to take charge. And well, kids are, and that's the thing. Kids are already taking charge in the household. I mean, I have a baby. I have a 3-year-old sister that everything that she may want, she gets. And it maybe she doesn't need it at all. And she plays with it 2 times, but she gets it. And my mom gets it for her. My mom goes to the grocery store and buys her yogurt when the girl doesn't even eat yogurt. But she gets it. And that, so that's what we, kids already are already in charge. But let's give them a goal. Let's give them chores that they would, you know, have some meaning to. I know washing dishes does have meaning to it. But shaving 10% off of your electricity bill also has meaning to it. So that's what Green My Parents is about, teaching kids that we're already leading, but parents, let us lead the electricity, because you're not doing a good job of it. So, and also, what else? Challenges.
National Wildlife Federation, partnership?
Oh, I was I work a little with the National Wildlife Federation. So I went to a green school, so I'm very, 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 very supportive of green schools. I'm very supportive of environmental education. I think environmental education is very important for kids from 11th, middle school, elementary, high school. I think it's crucial. But I'm more supportive of not necessarily a green school, but a green curriculum, and then a green school. But a green curriculum is more important than a green LEED building. And I've worked with National Wildlife Federation and their Eco Schools program. I worked with the Green Ambassadors that you saw. That was 4 years ago. So now, that was the first year that Green Ambassadors was actually a mandated environmental curriculum at the school. And now it is a curriculum that you can, that any school can take on from across the nation. So now it's called the Green Ambassadors Institute, where they teach teachers that want to teach green curriculum, how to teach green curriculum. They give them the skills. They give them the partnerships, the resources for grants and everything. And I'm from Los Angeles. I didn't say that. Did I say that I'm from Los Angeles? Yeah, I'm from Los Angeles. So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Jordan. And we're gonna have plenty of time for questions at the end. But what you said about the more important to have a green curriculum and a green school, that is so true. In Boulder, Colorado, there was a LEED certified school, and there was another school that didn't have that kind of money. And so the kids took it as a challenge to reduce their energy consumption. They ended up using less energy than the LEED certified school. And probably because the kids were taking it upon themselves to reduce their energy consumption, much like what the students in Green, Dream in Green did. So that's really interesting.
Yeah,
so,
I think it's, I've been to schools before where it's a LEED building and the superintendent takes us. I'm not bashing LEED or anything. I'm definitely a supporter of that. But I think it's more important because the school that I went to, I was there when we started. When Lynn Cherry came, that's when we started greening the school. And now you haven't been to the school, but it's a green building now. But the students were a part of it. And I can talk about it because I was there when that tree was planted. I was there when that urbanite amphitheater was created. So I was a part of it, and I did it, and so the students know about it. And I've been to LEED schools before where it's one of the best LEED schools in Arizona, and the students of the school that were giving us a tour, they knew nothing about it. We were given brochures, and they're like, oh, we've never seen those brochures, and they couldn't tell us about the LEED building. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the problems when we have to educate people. I need to know that I'm in a building that's created with FSC materials, because then I know what an FSC material is. So then when I get my own house, I say, okay, I want FSC material, and that's the way that you keep it going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You reminded me also, these films, Young Voices for the Planet, you've seen 2 of them, but there are 8 films. They're on the Internet, Young Voices on youngvoicesfortheplanet.com. So please, when you know, we're not going to have time to show them today, but please watch them there, because I show a real panoply of these success stories of young people planting 3 million trees, getting rid of plastics, plastic bags in Santa Monica, and then the stories that you're hearing here. So hope you find them useful. So Eric Christian, it's a real remarkable story, not just taking upon himself to make biodiesel, but then also this legislative side. And Eric is now an intern for a congressperson, is it? Congressperson?
Senator Ulrich.
Senator. So please tell us about what you've done, Eric.
Okay, well, I gathered my idea from a place called the Island School, which is in Eleuther in the Bahamas. And this was when I was in middle school. I went there on a dive trip, and I wound up crashing at the school because they were basically a semester school. You went there and you just took a couple courses down there. And they had their own biodiesel facility there. And like I said, I was just there on a dive trip, so I spoke to one of the islanders who was actually running the project after a student started it there. And he mentioned that they were collecting cooking oil from a local cruise liner called Caribbean Cruise Lines. And they were getting about 500 gallons of this cooking oil, and they were mixing it with methanol, which is essentially racing fuel for any of you NASCAR fans out there, and they turned it into biodiesel fuel, and they just throw it in a regular diesel engine. And I was like, that's insane, and that sounds really economically viable, considering that's a waste product. And so I thought to myself, I need to take this back with me somehow to my school. And with, you know, freshman year science fair rolling around, I thought to myself, well, why don't I do something with this? And so I started testing for different things, like how much energy I could get from peanut oil versus canola oil and so forth by converting it to biodiesel. And then I thought to myself, okay, so this is great. I've got all this research that I've done. What's the application behind it? So I went and spoke to the headmaster of the school, and I said, is there any way we could kind of establish a facility on campus so we could actually do something with cooking oil and the biodiesel that's been produced? And he said, as long as you keep us legal, do as you please. And so I was like, all right, this sounds good. So I spoke to a couple of my classmates, and they were all behind it as well. And we got together and decided to establish a facility on campus. And it was going to be a small 8x10 shed, but that's when we started realizing we ran into government red tape. The government had us file a monthly tax based on each gallon produced, and we had to send off all this paperwork, and it was just a hassle. And then on top of that, considering the school's private, it is tax exempt. So at the end of the month, we would file for, or at the end of the year, we would file for just a claim saying, hey, we can get our money back. And again, it just became a burden on government, and it became a burden on us and the faculty and staff as well. And it just dissuaded anybody from wanting to do anything about it. And so I wound up speaking with several different people, the senator who I am now interning with, and a few others in the House of Representatives, so that we could get this law changed. And I also spoke with the fire marshal, considering he was the one regulating the biofuel itself. So we determined where exactly the facility would be established, and a zoning instructor as well. And so eventually the law was signed into pass, and we now have a facility on Oak Hall's campus. And this all happened around my junior year that happened. So
what year was that?
2009. And I'm now a sophomore in college. So.
And can you tell us about whether this project has then moved to other schools? If you're teaching other schools how to do this?
One other thing that was kind of a byproduct was Alachua County. I wound up interning with them in between my senior year and freshman year of college. They decided to get their own biodiesel facility set up, and this is with the county. And so the government started applying it, which I found very interesting. And they're now collecting cooking grease from just different volunteers from the county and so forth. We collected it from different restaurants, and we collected it from the Rotary Club, and this is where we got our cooking oil supply. And we also collected it from parents. But what's interesting is now community members from surrounding areas are now supplying the government with biodiesel fuel, which I'm hoping they'll eventually put it in some of the local buses. So we'll see how that works out. And we also have spoken to a couple other high schools that are interested in carrying the project throughout, which is why we wound up, well, when, again, this was my senior year in high school, we wound up producing this biodiesel manual so that we could distribute it to other schools who would be interested in reproducing the idea. And that was kind of a byproduct there as well.
This is so interesting because you hear in the media a lot of negative things about biodiesel, especially, you know, large-scale biodiesel because of the whole problem with it taking food out of people's mouths and being made out of corn. But when it's made on a local level like this, you have it's made from what would, as you were saying, just be waste. And also, I was wondering, when you were working with on, in your school, was this integrated in, into any of the curriculum, like chemistry or at, you know, was there, or economics? Was there any actual curriculum tie-in with this project?
During my environmental science class, we wound up discussing just different alternative energies, and there was a heavy focus on biodiesel. So they started talking about that. And it's interesting that you mentioned that because Rudolf Diesel actually ran the first car on peanut oil. And ironically, like I said, it's just interesting that the school went back to biodiesel. And I think even more so, looking at it from how we didn't, you know, take peanut oil, like just strain new cooking oil, we collected it. It's all been used. It's all been used to cook food. So it's not like it is this, it doesn't get the negative publicity that biodiesel usually gets. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, that's really fascinating. And is that, is, you see it as a replicable project, sorry, mm-hmm. One that could be used in schools, you know, any school, anywhere in the country?
Right now, the law only applies to Florida, considering the way the government's set up. But it'd be neat if other schools could take it outside as well. And, I mean, whenever we filed the report and whenever we changed the law, it was set up for 1,000 gallons, considering the school wouldn't produce much more than that. And within the first 6 months, we only got 600 gallons. And considering, again, school's only in session 9 months out of 12 for the school year at high school, we figured there would be no need for it over that amount. So that's what the exemption applies for. But, I mean, if colleges start getting on board, then I could definitely see that being another need for a change in legislation.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to be blogging and Twittering and having, you know, this panel isn't going to end here. There's a lot of what you're saying will be coming, going out into the cyberspace world. So, Ken, I'd like to open this up to the audience for questions, and I'd also like to ask the panelists, how do you see what you've, you know, your projects that you've done getting out to a broader audience, sort of more widely, you know, becoming more mainstream, like in things that will happen in every school, that's just be kind of standard, not alternative. And Sean, I wanted you to make sure you mentioned that you're doing a conference in Sarasota and tell people about that, and is it open to the public?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to just...
So one of the things that I've seen with my work with ocean conservation in general and this project is that students are so receptive to the message. And it goes back to what Jordan said about education. I think everything ties in so well to that message. Before you're going to have young people or any people of any age go out and be passionate about an issue, they need to be educated about that. And that's what we've seen with this project and with all of these projects, it sounds like, as well. And so one of the things that I'm working to do is expand my work to other marine debris prevention initiatives and involve students in other ocean conservation work as well. And to help facilitate that, I've launched a Youth Ocean Conservation Summit. And it's going to be held on November 12th at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota. And basically this summit is a one-day event that's designed to allow students to come together, hear from scientists and conservationists about current threats to marine ecosystems, both locally and globally. And then they'll actually hear about what other youth are doing on ocean conservation projects as well. And they'll work with their peers to develop ocean conservation projects of their own on issues that they're interested about. And so we'll take them through that process. And that's why I mentioned some of those action guides from EarthEco and organizations. We'll be using those to really train them to launch these projects. And in the afternoon, we don't want to just leave them with an action plan, but we want to give them the tools to make those projects really successful. So the afternoon, we'll have a lot of workshops from local environmental organizations, as well as other youth presenters who will be helping to train these students how to do fundraising, how to work with the media, how to market their projects, and recruit project participants. So the goal is to really identify the needs that they have for their project and give them that support and that knowledge to make those successful. So I have a copy of the program, too, if you guys would like to see that after the presentation.
And Jordan won't be there physically, but she'll be making a video, right? Jordan, you want to tell people what your participation is going to be?
Oh, yeah. So I'll be talking to the crowd from a computer. So I'm making a video because I'm from Los Angeles, so that I won't have to come all the way back to Florida. I'm making a video. So, yeah, I'm making a video. So right now, I'm a sophomore in college. I work with different nonprofits. I work with different youth. I give public speaking workshops to different nonprofits. I work with different youth empowering programs. And I'm also a public speaker. I travel the nation to talk to colleges, high schools, middle school students, anybody that'll bring me out and talk to them and inspire their crowd to educate and inspire.
Are there any questions from the audience? I see that there's some students here, and we're really interested to hear your questions about you see any way that these projects that you've heard can be integrated into your school projects? Richard?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm. Richard, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Richard Zanger.
I just have to repeat the question for the recording. So Richard, how do you pronounce that? Zajac, and Richard worked on a project where they were able to get rid of styrofoam trays, was it, in your school? And his question is how they were able to overcome, how you, Panos, were able to overcome resistance when the other way, you know, the original way is maybe more convenient than what you're proposing.
I think it's all about the message. It's all about how you deliver the message. Because I went to a school where they did that a lot, and it was an environmental school, and that was in the name, but everyone didn't care. So we had to make them care. And that's what I used to tell my team all the time, like, we have to make them. So one of the things, what didn't they like about it? Did they like that it was convenient? Talk about how the school would save money, how the money could go to not only the environmental club, it can go to the sports club, it could go to the book club after school, it could go to more field trips, but make it more convenient for them. So tell them how they would like it and make them like it. I don't know. There's a way where you can manipulate people to get what you want, and you just have to do it in a way that they'll receive it.
Yeah, actually, at our school, our high school right now, every club has to have at least 30 members or else it's dissolved. So that's always one of the problems, is because we really have all these projects that we want to focus on, but we also have to focus on trying to get enough people to show up to the meeting while they also have like all their other community service clubs and all their sports after school. So it's really hard to get people to actually come and participate. One of the tools that we use is, hey, you get community service hours. Which is always a big deal. But then also, it totally 100% is trying to get people to care. And so, again, just like Jordan and everyone else, we are very focused on awareness projects. And I know in previous years we've done a lot of in-class discussions. So we take time out of the day and just go class by class and focus on a different topic and just engage in a discussion with the students and just talk about why these things are important.
I'd also like you to address how your projects spilled over from the youth to the adults and to the community. Do you know the story about Nicole's father? Or should I tell that story?
You can tell that.
Okay. Nicole was one of the other girls in the Dreaming in Green. She was wearing the orange sweater. And her father is in real estate, owns a lot of buildings in Miami. And at first he made fun of what these kids were doing, trying to reduce their energy consumption. But then when they saved $53,000, then he really woke up. He went and he switched out all his air conditioning units in all his Miami buildings. And he saved himself thousands of dollars. And those kinds of stories, I think, are so important, that how the youth can lead. and you know, especially when it comes to saving money. Do you want to comment on that? Whether it is.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what Jordan was saying about agreeing my parents and things as well, too. There's so many opportunities where if you can educate young people, they really are a great vehicle to take that message out into the broader community. And one of the things that I've seen with my work is that young people are probably the most receptive audience to learning about the problem and immediately wanting to change their lifestyle or what they're doing to help affect change and change that issue. I know when I talk to students about fishing line recycling, they are... And I get great responses from adults, too, but they are the most receptive audience to wanting to help out any way they can. I had a 10-year-old email me last week and say, "Hi, Sean, I read about your project. I love the ocean. I love animals. Just tell me whatever I can do to help." And he's going to be working now, hopefully, with us in the next couple months to make recycling bins with his school. It's really exciting to see how you know young people can get involved in these projects. They're not hard for them to do, but they can really take that out to the broader community and make a really big impact.
And make sure to involve the student body in the conversation, because that's what sometimes when you're not in that club, and I used to talk about that all the time, like the environmental club would be like an elitist group, and it's a group of 7 or a group of 12, and they want to do everything green, but just make sure you're involving the entire student body in, so they feel like they're a part of it, so then they'll want to do something as well, and it's not just you telling them what to do.
Can you talk about whether, like, what rewards the student body is going to get? Like, how do they see themselves as benefiting from what you know from these projects, or do they?
I know at our school this last year we planted a butterfly garden, and kids who never even cared before have been coming up to me saying, "Oh, I saw a butterfly in the garden. I ate lunch out there," and it's kind of inspiring them. And it's not necessarily saving energy on the electricity bill, but it's something that's getting people to notice it, and it's getting people to realize that they can do something.
Yeah, and then also in terms of the actual electricity bill, when we do save money, our school, we have no paper. We have all of our printers are broken. We have basically no money.
We're a public school.
Right. Public school in Florida. And... yeah, that's always a problem because teachers now, they all have their own websites, and so any homework assignment or anything, all these scanned papers are up online, and we have to go home and print them all and do everything instead of getting handouts or instead of just, like, looking at everything online. They're actually, like, making us print all these things. And then also we don't have any textbooks, which is kind of a problem. And so... all this money and everyone, even if students are like, yes, no textbooks, which means no homework, it actually is necessary, and they do agree that we do need money, and I think everyone can recognize that the school would benefit tremendously by having more money, and this is one way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. So, Eric, can you also chime in and tell us about the involvement of the student body and what kind of stories that you could share with us?
Certainly. Honestly, I think the trick is finding a way to make it convenient. I mean, one thing that we mentioned was, again, the students would have to bring some of their cooking oil to school with them in the morning. Well, think about it. If you have a 15-minute drive from home to school, you can get a community service, like a full hour of community service, just by bringing 4 jars of cooking oil with you to school. So, I mean, that was just kind of like, again, finding little tricks that can make it work for the system instead of working against it. And,
so you basically created a cooking oil recycling program that where the parents can collect cooking oil and have the kids bring it to school and use it as part of your project?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. And, I mean, a lot of the students were – I didn't have to face a lot of challenges when it came time to production because a lot of the students were interested – well, some of them were nerds and science fans. Mm-hmm. So they were interested in engineering and that kind of thing too. So, I mean, seeing how you can – retrofit an engine so that it runs on pure biodiesel versus diesel engines or mixing the oil itself is something that fascinated them as well. So again, making it interesting is always a key.
Are there any other questions from the audience?
Sure. Uh-huh. I have a few. Eric, what's the name of your school?
Oak Hall High School.
If that's up today,
yes.
Mm-hmm. And Jordan, I was curious,
Green Ambassadors Institute.
Green Ambassadors.
Yes. Okay. So, does everyone know what a charter school is?
Yeah.
Okay, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it's still a public school. It's still a public school. But they work through grants. They have to find some of their own resources through grants and other, but it's still a public school.
Well, can you tell us your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. David Sullivan. I'm the managing editor of a magazine called BioCycle. We cover renewable energy and organic recycling. And my question is, sometimes it's comments can be a little depressing. You know, we're learning about global warming every day. One of the comments that someone made in a session yesterday was that we're sort of stuck in the carbon footprint of the culture that we grew up in. So you guys probably haven't had any burden with the youth of the United States. How do you feel about that?
I'll repeat your question for the tape. So this is, you said Dan Sullivan from BioCycle, okay? And question was, so how, sometimes these issues can be depressing. So how do you see youth, you know, what you've inherited, how do you sort of, what's your philosophy about having inherited the world as it is and moving forward? And
what,
in this consumer culture?
Well, I've never been depressed. We talked about that. Well, no, I've been depressed, but I've never been depressed about environmental issues. And we talked about that earlier, and Lynn's like, and I'm like, no, I'm not depressed. But I've never been depressed because there are solutions. And I feel like I can be depressed and be stuck in a depression, or I can act on it and go out and teach solutions so that that wouldn't happen. So I've never been depressed about this because there's a better way. It doesn't have to end up like that. And I see that's I've never been depressed about environmental issues.
That's so interesting. I just wanted to add to that we're now doing a study for 100 schools and after school programs, and there will be a questionnaire before young people see these films, and then asking them exactly this question, like, what is your sort of psychological baseline? How do you feel about your relationship to the earth, about what you've inherited, about the environment? Are you hopeful? Are you not hopeful? Then showing these films, which show young people who are very empowered and they're very inspiring, and then another questionnaire to see if seeing other young people doing something that's proactive, taking action, changes the state of mind of other people, adults and young people as well. So if any of you are interested in participating in this study, showing the films in your school, if any of you are, you know, involved with schools, we'd really love to have you as part of the study. So can you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Don Corrigan. I'm a journalism educator at Webster University and kind of an environmental journalism certificate. When I go out to, like, middle school sometime when they invite me, and for lack of a better term, when I talk to the A-track kids, I'll ask them, how many of you are aware of global warming and believe that it's happening? And it'll be 90%. And they're all on board. But then when I go to the bigger group, which I would call the B-track kids, and talk to them, it's like a total opposite. It's like, oh, that's, we don't believe in the friggin' global warming. That's a bunch of baloney. My dad says that's stupid and all stuff. And do you guys see the same sort of thing? And how do you break through that sort of elitist thing that being green is sort of, we're the elite kids, we're better than you guys. And then there's this reaction from the other group that, oh, those are the nerd kids, those are the elite kids. So mm-hmm. You see that divide sometimes, and how do you cross that divide? How do you get the other students to feel the same concern?
Well,
do you want to
repeat the question?
Yes.
Can you tell a story about the Orthodox?
I ran my school.
Well, I know how you do it. You manipulate.
That's all I'll say, but I did. I ran my school.
You were part of the now. Do you remember that?
I think one thing, it goes back to kind of targeting your message to the specific audience. You know, people who are already aware of it, you know, and people who are that HVAC student that you're talking about who's on board with the environmental message, it's taking them to the next level, getting them engaged and active and really proactive and working on solutions to problems. But then to bring those other students up to that level, it's tailoring your message to fit each student and making it somehow, you know, relate to them. I know I've gone and tutored kids in science for community service with 4-H before in inner city schools in Atlanta, and I'm talking to kids about ocean conservation that are in their textbook they're studying right now, and they haven't seen an ocean, and it's a matter of relating it to them. Kind of a story like that. My brother actually taught 6th grade special education in the Bronx for the past 3 years. And I remember this past Earth Day, he told me, we got into a big discussion about Earth Day, and we brought up your project, and we're talking about that. And he said, you know, these kids became really interested. They may not even know where the oceans are, but it's a matter of making that connection, showing them whether it's pictures or things they can relate to make a connection and make them want to get more involved and want to learn more. I know we talk a lot about people aren't going to care about conservation. They're not going to be interested unless it somehow impacts their life or something they love and appreciate and care about. And so I know with my project, I show pictures of dolphins entangled in fishing line. But it's a matter of identifying that key point where you can connect with them. And for each specific project, it may be a little bit different. But if you can find some way to show how it's relevant to their life and something they love and appreciate, then you can really move them to that next stage of wanting to be engaged and proactive in conservation work.
Our middle school teacher gave us a project for us to research who funded a lot of the studies that are fueling this sentiment that it's not real, global warming is a hoax among these kids. And it actually turned out that ExxonMobil was funding most of those studies. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of goes to show that if we teach these kids who think it's fake to look deeper into where they're getting their information, maybe they would see that there's a bit of a bias there.
Can you tell us more about that project and who the teacher was? Because I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, that was Ms. Vasquez at Carver.
Our 8th grade biology teacher. And I actually read an article recently written by a university professor that showed that ExxonMobil funded this disinformation campaign using the same people that tobacco companies hired to fund their disinformation campaign, which I just thought was kind of interesting. No, it was
ExxonMobil. Oil companies.
No, I heard
the magazine was. It's called Environment. Is a magazine just Environment? It's different university professors and also people experts in their field writing sort of scientific articles about different environmental problems. And then the other thing that I had to say in response to the question was that at our school, we have different academies. One of the academies, I think Larissa mentioned briefly, is called IB, the International Baccalaureate, and that is sort of like the nerds. Like, it's more advanced curriculum, and those are definitely the students who are involved in the green team.
I will admit there is an IB bubble that we live in for the most part.
And so I can't say that we've completely successfully crossed that border and reached out to the other people, but part of our in-class discussions and stuff do try to reach out to them. And we're definitely focusing. I know we had somebody wanted to make us like an honor society, our environmental club, and we didn't want to do that because I don't think that there should be any like GPA requirements or any academic requirements to make you go green. And a lot of our members this year, our club did grow a lot so far, and there's a lot of non-IB students there, so I think that's helping.
And also there's a class of autistic kids at our school who are actually very active in recycling. They enjoy like shredding the paper and activities like that, and they actually participate a lot.
Mm-hmm. Are there any more questions from the audience? Can you identify yourself?
Susan Becker. I'm involved in the New River Middle School for the Marine Biology Magnet School for Middle School here in Broward County. First off, I want to congratulate you guys. You're doing a super job. Now I have to apologize because it's the generation before me and my greedy generation that has put this burden on you and their generation. Truly it is. Having been an involved mom, seeing what you guys are doing, and of course trying to persuade us, we're kind of the old dogs that don't want to change our tricks. It was horrible. Greed was not good, trust me. But
how are you getting back into the elementary schools? Because when you have the little kid that goes, I want, and she gets what she wants, how are we persuading them to say, no, Mom, no more plastic, no more this? Because when I was in the elementary schools, let me tell you, they're the biggest non-recyclers, the biggest waste. All the little juice boxes, all the little plastics are coming out. Tons and tons are going out in the elementary schools. So do you see yourselves trying to implement some of your projects even down to the next generation coming up?
Well, one thing that I found interesting was that we had the elementary school kids bringing in cooking oil as well. And the local regional utility company, GRU, put out these little plastic lids, which essentially is a universal lid for any kind of container. So however their parents chose to dispose of the cooking oil, they could place it there. And one thing to piggyback up on your idea about really affecting the students is having them be able to relate to it, because one thing I mentioned to a bunch of my classmates several times was, well, do you want your school bus smelling like diesel, or would you like the smell of French fries? And it kind of took a different approach. But in terms of the responsibility aspects, too, just to show you how much of a dork I am, I'm going to quote a Carl Sagan video. We're all connected to each other biologically, to the earth chemically, and to the rest of the universe atomically. And so in that sense, I think we're all, to some degree, responsible. So whether we're, you know, reaching our older age or whether we're in our youth, we all have a part to play in this. And that's just how I feel about the topic.
When we did Rise Above Plastics, and so when I created Rise Above Plastics, I wanted to go to middle school and high school students. And every time they said, okay, well, what about, and the presenters, they were like, I want to go to elementary. And I'm like, no, that's too hard. Like, because then we'll have to do an entire other presentation. It's more training. I don't want to do elementary. We finally did elementary towards the end. And I was one of the people that I was one of the presenters that day, and it was the best presentation we'd ever done. The best reception of the audience, because when you have little kids are, I don't know how to say it in a way that's not, little kids, they bother you. And whether it's in a good way or a bad way, they bother you and they get excited. So all you have to, we just have to teach them. I think now elementary is actually the most important environmental education, because they'll be pests to their parents. And, you know, when the mom is getting plastic at the grocery store, no, where are your reusables? When you leave the car, you forgot your reusable bags, and they'll be pests about it. So we just have to teach them. I think that was my favorite group, and I have to tell everyone, like, yeah, I'm sorry that I said I didn't want to go to elementary school, because that was the best, most exciting audience that we had done.
Sean?
Yeah, and I think it's so important, too, that we don't forget to target that younger age group. Because sometimes, I know we get in this mode, like, you know, young people, it's so great that they're engaged, and we always think, you know, middle and high school age youth, you know, that's so exciting to see them. But it's so important to start at even that younger age group. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, about, you know, how you feel about that carbon footprint that you grew up kind of modeling. And so the younger you can target students, the better. And like Jordan said, they're so receptive to it. Maybe they don't know at first. Maybe they're, you know, they're younger students. They may not have heard the message before. But it's always, from what I've seen, is once they hear that message, they are some of the most enthusiastic students that I've ever worked with. And I know other organizations are realizing that, too. I work with a lot of service organizations like Earth Echo and other just general service organizations. And they're working to really target younger and younger age groups. This book, Going Blue, is now going to be coming out in an elementary school version. This was for high schoolers. So there's going to be a lot more resources and a lot of a push to reach out to that younger age group and really engage them as much as possible. Because it's really surprising. Once they get excited, they're really enthusiastic about it. And I've had 5-year-olds with me making recycling bins. You know, and it's things that are easy that we can find for them to do, but that really empower them. And if they grow up in that with that mentality, it'll only just be instilled in them for the rest of their life.
Thanks.
And I know that Dream in Green, the program that we are a part of, they try to implement, give teachers curriculum to use in all their classes, and they have like separate elementary, middle school, and high school things. And then so in Florida, for those of you who are not from Florida, we have the FCAT, a standardized testing. And what they've done is actually taking each of the different standards that they have to teach for the FCAT and giving them like find an environmental idea and apply it to that standard so that all the schools can all use these. And there's been studies that show that kids are actually do better on the FCAT if they are given this more hands-on and education that they can apply to their own life.
Yeah, there's many studies that show that when the education is relevant, that that the kids do much better. We've got to wrap up, but I wanted to let you know that Eric has a slideshow on his computer on the back table. If anyone want to see that, the everyone on the panel is available for interviews afterwards. If any of you want to do individual interviews, if you're interested in the DVD, we have DVDs, and I also have postcards I'd like to give out to all of you. They're free postcards. And the announcement that from SEJ is that beginning after the session, we will discuss the Forest Service new management, new proposed planning rule. The planning rule will govern the management of all national forests. Over 300,000 public comments have been received on how the rule will impact the environment, timber industry, and the recreational industry. So you can bring your questions to the chief. But I would like to thank you all so much for coming today. I hope that we'll hear more from you. Please stay in touch with me, with everyone on the panel. Get our contact information. Twitter, tweet. We want to hear what you're doing. And remember that every one of you can make a huge difference in the world. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.